I am trying to avoid my mind being kind of polluted by the real world. I call it clean mind theory. When you wake up in the morning, every morning, you've got a clean mind again. It's like wipe the slate clean. And so you deal with the things you have to, the routine things that you do every day that don't require you to get involved in, you know, sort of engaged in conversation with people on social media or think about how you're going to reply to emails.
Welcome to Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing with your host, John Robinson IV. Here we smash walls, demolish writer's block, and learn how to harness the true power of storytelling. Let's get started. Anthony Johnston is a versatile writer of novels, comics, and video games, which include titles such as Dead Space, Shadow of Mordor, Silent Hill, Daredevil, Shang-Chi, Atomic Blonde, and so much more. What's interesting is that his productivity book, The Organized Writer, tells us how he's been able to write so much. Welcome to the Beyond the Fourth Wall of Writing podcast. I'm your host, John Robinson IV. Here with me today, I have Mr. Anthony Johnston. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. How you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, I'm glad to be able to talk to you. You have written a billion things. it's always awesome to like see a rap sheet or somebody with a rap sheet that's that long. And then I'm just like, man, one day I'm going to get to that level. But it's always like, it's never like a, it's like, I guess it can be overwhelming, but it's never something that like keeps me from trying. It's kind of the opposite. It's like,
sure,
let me go for that, you know? And then sometimes I look at people's rap sheet and I go, yeah, I should be writing more often than, you know, playing X game or whatever. but I'm glad you're here. I would like to, like I said, as usual, I like to open things up by asking what your favorite writing advice is, or if you would like to answer them the other way, you can give what your writing advice you hate the most.
Well, I'll tell you both, and because it may be amusing, because I have a feeling most people who answer this question probably will say the opposite of what I'm about to say.
I got you.
Because I am somebody who advocates for writing every day. And I know a lot of writers hate that advice, but I give that advice all the time. And that's what I live by. That's the routine I have. It's my process. Yeah. And for people who are struggling, it's always what I advise: write something every day, even if it's like 200 words, you know, can't write 200 words, but even that is progress and will eventually get you towards finishing a project. And then the advice that I really don't like is write what you know. It's not that it's bad advice per se, but people misinterpret it, or people who give it don't explain what they mean. Write what you know from a sort of emotional point of view, I think is absolutely valid and is very important. You know, that's part of the empathy of being a writer, is ensuring that you can understand and that you know the emotional impact of what your characters are going through and the sort of what's at stake for them emotionally. But too many people think that it means, I don't know, that you have to be an airline pilot to write about, you know, to write about planes or something. And that's absolutely not the case. You know, that's what research is for. So it really bugs me when I hear people give that advice without, and I know that they mean it the right way. They mean it sort of emotionally and experientially, but not literally. But they don't explain that. And so the audience goes away thinking, oh no, I'm not a policeman. How can I possibly write a book about a, you know, detective or something? That's not what we mean.
Right. Yeah, no, I really like that, because that is that the write what you know is probably one of the most polarizing, like, you know, pieces of advice, because of that, because the meanings get misconstrued.
Exactly.
You know, some people may say, well, if you're saying write what you know and only write what you know, that means that I need to write in my experience. So if I'm like a black kid from Chicago, I should only write about black experiences and only from Chicago.
You know? Exactly. It's just, it limits everyone. Nobody benefits from it. And of course, that's not to, you know, say the own voice work isn't important, because of course it's absolutely vital. But it shouldn't be restrictive in that sense. You shouldn't think, yeah, that, as you say, a black guy from Chicago can't write, I don't know, about a sort of a Scottish guy who's getting married or something. I don't know, whatever. Right. you've got to be able to have that empathy and break out from your own direct experiences. And that's why life experience is so important. I mean, just to get philosophical for a moment, that's why life experience is so important to writers. It's so important for writers to do things, to get out there and, you know, learn about people and have contact with people and experience people. And that's not easy for a lot of writers. A lot of writers are very kind of hermits by nature, you know, me included. I'm not a particularly gregarious person, but it's so important to get out there and see the world and see what people are like and what human behavior is like. And that's what will make you a better writer.
Right. Absolutely. Like knowledge, I think all knowledge helps writers. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, like anytime you're learning anything, like I call it your writer's brain when you're thinking, like when your writer's brain is turned on. And almost anything will pop up. I said it earlier, you know, the time that could be something. I don't know what it could be, but it could be something, you know?
Yeah. We're sponges. Yeah.
Right. Right. So anything to me is like a writing idea. If I'm watching the old Anthony Bourdain's travels where he used to go across and do the, like that stuff was culturally very immersive, you know? Things that you would have never known about unless you had been there and had experienced those things. And stuff like that is just inspiring, you know? And so in that way, right, what you know is kind of like, well, if you don't know it, but you watch something like, you know, History Channel or was that Discovery? I can't remember. Something like that.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it was. Then you're learning that thing. Or at least you're hitting the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg about that thing. And then you can pursue more of it. Learn more about it, and then therefore you will, maybe you don't know it intimately, maybe obviously you don't live that culture, but you're learning something about that culture that you may be able to apply and dig deeper into, you know.
That's absolutely true. But also, again, talking sort of emotionally, the thing that programs like that are really good at is showing that people are kind of the same and have the same problems wherever you go. You know, the specifics of a culture might be different, but deep down, really, we all, you know, have the same wants and desires and problems and family problems and relationship problems. Right. And people are still jealous or, you know, proud of their families and things like that. All these things are universal. The details are different. And that's what research and absolutely watching a show like that is, you know, really helpful with that kind of stuff. But also, like I say, it demonstrates that actually we're all kind of the same. And that's really important for, I think, for writers to know, especially writers of fiction, because that way you can write believable, relatable, and engaging characters without having to have that lived experience necessarily, because you can tap into a sort of a universal well of emotional behaviors.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. That's very... what's the Jungian,
collective, I guess.
Yeah, the collective, I can't remember the
collective unconscious. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. But I really like that. It's the same way that you can, that movie, Everything, Everywhere All at Once. Excellently, because they were in different worlds and all different kinds of things. And
right.
We were able to relate to, for example, rocks. And rocks aren't even, I mean, they're inanimate objects. And I was so amazed with that movie because I really felt like I was about to cry over a rock. And I think that movie gets to the epitome of that, like finding what you can connect to on a universal level, you know.
Exactly.
Well, in that case, multiversal, but you know.
Yeah.
But no. So I love that. So, I mean, let's dig a little bit into more, okay, like your process, because you mentioned there's the write what you know, and then the write every day. So I know some people will go like, write every day. Oh, we have,
I know,
our lives are. But to some extent, I think I do agree, because like when you break it down to like something, you know, like even if you're working like the 200 words, something is progress, you know, and it keeps your mind kind of keyed in. So with that, what is kind of your process, like on your day-to-day, like what does it look like for you in terms of the writing process?
So my day-to-day actually has it. I don't have a set routine, but I have set things that I try to achieve. In my book, The Organized Writer, I do actually set out a sort of typical day for me. And it's true, that is an accurate representation of what a typical day for me is like. You know, what time I wake up, take the dogs out, you know, and then sort of sit down to work, then have some lunch, et cetera, et cetera. It's like I said, it's only typical. It's not every day. And depending on what I'm working on at the time, like, for example, the last nearly year and a half, I was working on a big video game project for Bad Robot. And obviously they're based in LA. So I was working on LA time. So my my timetable was completely out of the window. It was completely different to anything that I've, you know, published in a book. But the principle was still the same, which is that I get up in the morning and I don't check my email and I don't check Twitter and I don't go on social media. And instead, I take care of sort of what I have to do. Like I said, you know, maybe take the dogs out or whatever, have breakfast, that kind of stuff. And then I sit down and start writing. And the reason I do that is because I am trying to avoid my mind being kind of polluted by the real world. I call it clean mind theory. When you wake up in the morning, every morning, you've got a clean mind again. It's like wipe the slate clean. And so you deal with the things you have to, the routine things that you do every day that don't require you to get involved in, you know, sort of engaged in conversation with people on social media or think about how you're going to reply to emails. None of that. Instead, just deal with your daily routines and then sit down to write. And then it's early in the day, so you've got lots of energy. You know, most people, I know not everybody's a morning person, but even people who aren't morning people, you do just literally have more energy when you, you know, after you've woken up. Or maybe you've just come back from the gym or something. Because, you know, that's certainly true of me several days a week. And as I say, your mind isn't kind of polluted by the real world yet. So your imagination is free to roam. And to write and be creative and, you know, come up with all the things that you need to write to progress from where you were yesterday. And I do that and I advocate for doing that for a set quantity of words or pages if you're writing a script. And then when you reach that quota, let's say you're writing a screenplay and your quota is 5 pages. Once you've written those 5 pages, you can carry on if you're feeling good, if you've got the energy, if you go, hey, you know, actually I can bang out another couple of pages here. This is great. This is going well. Or you can go, oh, I'm not really feeling it today, but I've hit my 5 pages. So I'm going to go off and do something else. Now I'm going to go and have dinner. Now I'm going to go and answer my email, take care of admin, you know, or family business or whatever you've got to do, knowing that you have achieved that quota, knowing that you've made you've written your words or your pages for the day. And so if you come back and do that again the next day and you keep doing that, you know that you're making that progress every single day as a kind of minimum amount. And so that's what I do. And I do that regardless of how long it takes. That's an important part of the process. So it's not sit down and write for 2 hours, because I could easily sit here for 2 hours and not write a single word. you know, that we all know that happens. Every writer has had days like that where you sit there for an hour and nothing is coming out. It's like pulling teeth. So that can happen. So instead, if it's a word count or a page count, then even if it gets done in like 90 minutes, you know, if I'm having a really good day, I might hit that word count or that page count in an hour or 90 minutes, and I know that if I want to, I can stop at that point and it's okay. Because that's my quota. I've reached my quota. Of course, then there are the bad days where it takes 5 or 6 hours to get the quota out. But again, at the end of it, you still know that you've made that progress. You know you've hit that quota. And so it's a weight off your mind. When you do step away from your work, you at least have that peace of mind of knowing that you haven't fallen behind in your progress. And so, yeah, as I say, that is my routine. I do that until I've made my quota. Then I turn to email and social media and admin and, you know, dealing with publishers and family stuff and eat something and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, maybe watch a movie or whatever, or read a book. And then that kind of segues into my evening. So, like I say, it's not always as rigidly defined as I had it in the book, but it's always the same criteria. It's always the same in principle.
Right. Yeah. This thing is what I'm going to do, or this is my minimum for the day. And no matter what that has to be done for the day, most easily in the morning.
Exactly. For me, I mean, you know, as I say, there are always caveats. Some people have other stuff that they have to do in the morning, you know, family commitments or whatever. Some people don't have the luxury of having a separate room where they can go and write, and they have to go out to a coffee shop, or they have to, you know, find a corner of their lounge or something where they might be disturbed. Of course, there are always, you know, everybody's circumstances are different. I'm talking about sort of from an ideal point of view. But if you can follow that in principle, no matter how the details may differ, then you will make progress and you will finish your work. It's worked for me for the last 20 years. So I am speaking directly from experience.
Right. So you write, obviously, like that's your primary full-time writing. So obviously there's going to be a lot of people who are at different stages. Like for example, I work at, you know, I work IT during the day. Yeah, sure. Life stuff, like today I had jury duty, I knew before, but you know, I had jury duty. so like things pop up in life. What kind of advice would you give people who have where writing isn't their primary yet, but they still want to, you know, still put out books or achieve their writing goals?
Well, I mean, that was me for years. You know, I didn't sort of immediately start writing and go full time. It took years for me to get published and to sort of work my way to a point where I could become a full time writer. So I absolutely understand and I sympathize. And the simple answer is that you have to then do it in your spare time. You know, obviously either before you go to work in the morning or after, you've got to do it in one of those two times. I have friends who are now, you know, professional full-time authors who began they just got up an hour earlier than they did, you know, than they normally would have, especially if they had kids, in order to get an hour of writing done in the morning, while the house was quiet and before everybody else woke up, before they had to go to work. And that was how they got their work done. I know people who work late at night. They go to work, they come home, they have dinner with their partner or something, and then they spend 2 or 3 hours, you know, upstairs in the spare room or whatever, working until 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning. That was what I did. That was my routine. Rather than getting up early, I did it, you know, late at night. And that was partly because I'm here in the UK and I was working primarily with comics publishers based in the US. So it was it was just more convenient because it was easier to email people at that time. So one way or another, you figure out how to do it. And as I say, I understand it's a luxury to be a full-time writer and have, you know, a separate study and be able to dictate your timetable and all that sort of thing. Of course, I understand those are luxuries. But one way or another, you have to find the time to write. And what's most important, I think, is making it a routine. So whether it's an hour in the morning, whether it's 2 hours at night, maybe it's only at weekends. Maybe you absolutely cannot find the time during the week. And the only time you can get is, say, a Sunday morning or something, you know, maybe you can get 3 hours on a Sunday morning. But if you can get 3 hours every Sunday morning, then you can develop that routine and those habits and go, this is my writing time. This is when I am going to sit down and make progress. And so, yes, your progress will be slower than somebody who can work every day, but you will still make progress as long as you sit down and write every Sunday morning or whenever it is. So I really think that kind of making a routine of it, making it habit, building habits, good habits, is the key to making that sort of progress. And that's true whether writing is or isn't your full-time job. You know, again, the principle is the same. The details may differ. The circumstances may differ, of course. But the principle is still make it a routine and do it either every day or every week or whenever you can, but do it at the same time each time so that it becomes a habit. And that will, you're kind of removing one of the barriers then, because your mind, you'll anticipate it, your mind will prepare itself for, I am going to start writing in 2 hours time or whatever. And so when you sit down at your desk or at your corner of the kitchen table or wherever you're writing, then you're prepared for it and you're sort of mentally ready to try and get into the zone.
Yeah, I like that. Because I think that's not only true of writing, to be honest. I think that's true of like anything you want to do. It's the consistency, because it's so easy. Like, it's all the things that are available to do in life. It's so easy to just kind of wake up in the morning. If there's things you have to, like, for example, you have to go to work, right? So if I'm, I've got to go to work. And if I'm not thinking about anything in my day but work, the likelihood of me getting off of work and then just like, you know, getting the kids together, getting something to eat, and then like maybe chilling and watching TV or playing a video game, the likelihood of that happening, plus maybe there's some emails that I have to send, or maybe there's some, you know, some other like other just business to take care of. The likelihood of me doing those things, and then the very last thing on my list is writing, therefore I don't do it, is very high. If it's not, you know, kind of written down as a task to do consistently on it every day, or even if it's not every day, I guess if some people set it up, I tell people often, even if you can't do it every day, like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, for example.
I
think if you know that that's one of your tasks for the day, the same level as maybe work for that day, or the same level as responding to whatever email that's important or whatever for that day, when you set things at a higher priority, I think you're more likely to do it, especially if you do it consistently. You know?
Yeah, I think it's the consistency even more than the priority, to be honest. Right. I think that is the most important thing. I mean, personally, I would still advocate for making writing the sort of the very next thing down on your list after kind of family essentials, after you've done everything that you have to do for your day job and your family and make sure your family is sort of looked after,
right?
Then the writing should be next, before emails, before social media, before Call of Duty, you know, whatever. If you want to be a writer, you have to write, and you have to make writing, you know, what that priority. As I say, no, of course, not above things like family and your day job, but right. It must be the very next thing, because otherwise, as you say, there's always something else that can fill up the time. There's always something else you can be doing that isn't writing. And I'm the same. Full-time writers, we're all the same as well. We are notorious procrastinators, you know? Right. If we can find something else to do that isn't writing, that feels like it's really important, we'll do it. So don't feel you're alone in that at all. But what professional writers do is develop those habits, those routines, and that willpower to a certain extent, that discipline to say, no, the writing is the most important thing. And even if I don't get round to answering that email, even if I don't get round to checking Twitter, even if I don't get round to maybe even some, frankly, you know, kind of domestic things that you want to do, building shelves, you know, those shelves that I really want to build in the corner of the study. Well, are they really more important than writing? No, not if you're a writer. And so that's the kind of, those are the sometimes difficult decisions that you have to make. But like I say, writers write. You have to make it a priority.
Right. And I think there is, so there's something that I've, and this may just be me, like some people don't agree. I'm a little hard on myself sometimes, but I do think there's a such thing as, what's the word? Like toxic positivity. And what I mean by that is there's the idea that, and don't get me wrong, I do believe that people who don't write every single day are writers. You know, and I do.
Of course,
believe
if
you write once a week, like you said, on just Sunday or something like that, it doesn't make you not a writer. Sometimes you take a lot of time off and you come back to it. DJ Older was on this podcast and he talked about that exact thing. He's a huge advocate for self-care, you know.
Sure. Taking sabbaticals, that sort of thing, yeah.
Right, exactly. And so I'm all for that. But the counterbalance is, there is kind of that, all right, if I want to claim this title or claim that I'm this thing, or if I'm serious about, not even claiming the title, forget the title. If I'm serious about this thing, if I want to produce work, then there has to be some level of standard for it. You know, whether it's every day, every Monday, Wednesday, whatever, yeah. Every Sunday, there has to be some standard for it. And the reason why I brought up the toxic positivity is that sometimes there's a lot of, oh, don't worry about it. It's okay. It's okay if you didn't write all last year, and you know, and it's kind of like, I understand it. I do kind of feel it, but also let's encourage people to try to get some kind of consistent schedule. Like, not, it doesn't have to be an aggressive, like, you better write, but yeah, it can be an encouraging thing.
Well, I think the thing there is, it is okay if you didn't write last year. If you go a whole year and you haven't written, that's fine. Are you happy? Are you healthy? Are you well? Those are the important things. But at the same time, maybe you're not a writer. Maybe it's just not for you. Lots and lots of people want to be writers. It's probably the thing more people in the world want to do than anything else. You know, like, everybody says, oh, I've got a book inside of me. I want to write a book one day or whatever. Everybody thinks they're a writer. Everybody, or rather, I should say, everybody thinks they want to be a professional writer. Right. And the truth is that not everybody is cut out for it. And that's not a failing on their part. It's not some kind of flaw of their moral character. It's just that not everybody is cut out for sitting by themselves in a chair for hours every day, not speaking to anybody at all, right, and just sort of writing down things that they are making up in their head. It's fun to do. I love it. But for some people, it's fun to do at first, and then they kind of go, and fall by the wayside. And that's okay. Not everybody has to be a writer. Not everybody is cut out to be a writer. I'm not cut out to be, I don't know, a bus driver. I'm not cut out to be a teacher. I'm not cut out to be a rocket scientist. You know, different people do different things, and that's okay. So, you know, that's the flip side of that kind of that positivity is like, yeah, it is okay if you didn't write last year. The most important thing is your mental health, no question. Right. But at the same time, you also then have to reassess, is this actually something you want to do? Right. Is this, you know, you say you want to do this, but you're not actually doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when you kind of question, well, therefore, are you actually somebody who wants to do this, like for real? Or are you somebody who thinks it would be nice to be a writer?
Right.
And there are plenty of those people around. And like I say, there's nothing wrong with that. Loads of people want to be a writer. I think it is a fantastic job. I think it's perfectly natural that everybody wants to be a writer. But at the same time, not everybody is cut out for it.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's like the hard truth that a lot of people don't really want it. That's what I mean. It, like, something like that, if I were to say that on Twitter, I probably have a lot of people.
Oh, God, yeah. put on your flame retardant waistcoat, yeah.
Right, right. A lot of people will probably come after me for it. But I do think there's some level of it. Yeah, I think that's true. And again, if you take time off and you come back to it, you know, I think it's more of being honest with yourself. Like, yeah, if you...
Exactly.
If you wrote, you know, consistently for a while, and then you know, maybe you fell off of it, something happened, life happens or whatever. That happened with me with working out in the last quarter of last year. I was super consistent until, like, somewhere around the last quarter, something happened at work. I ended up having to switch jobs, like, you know, and like my mind was all over the place. So, like, actually writing came kind of fell to the wayside a little bit too during that period. And that's life. Like, sometimes those things happen.
Yeah, sure.
I think being aware of that and saying, okay, yeah, this thing happened, and also I kind of slacked a little bit, but also I know that I will be returning to my regular schedule.
Right. If you still feel driven to get back to it, yeah.
Right, right. And then once you feel the drive, doing it, like everybody, like, kind of, you know, at certain points over with different things falls to the wayside. And I think it's the mental state of knowing that, okay, I'm getting back to it, and I know exactly how long I've been away from it. 3 months is too long. I'm back to it now. And then you do it the next day. You know, I think that's important. But no, but really, the top of it all is consistency. Like, that's the number one for me. But yeah, so we talked a little bit about, like, you know, your again, the organ, I'm not gonna lie, the organized writer was the was like one of my main eye-opening things, you know, when it came to just kind of like focusing my mind. I'm curious of what you mentioned some of it in the book as well, but just to hear maybe something's updated since the book as well. But what kind of tools do you use, like, on a day-to-day in terms of like organization and time and, you know?
I'm really simple and kind of old fashioned in some ways. I mean, and this is, yeah, something that I talk about in the book. The actual tools, the like specific tools that you use, I don't think are that important as long as they're the right mm-hmm. tools for you. Like, I can tell you what I use and people go, aha, therefore I'll start using those things, but they may not be right for you. What's important is figuring out what works for you and then using that and sticking to it. Like, I draft everything, for example, in an app called Scrivener, which I've been using now for 15 plus years, basically since it launched. I write everything in Scrivener, like novels, comic books, screenplays, video games, everything I write in Scrivener, even blog posts and stuff get written in Scrivener first. Nice. I'm really comfortable using it. But it's not for everyone. I have good friends who, because they hear me evangelizing about it, have tried to use Scrivener. They go, I just can't get on with it, man. And I'm like, it's okay. It's okay. I can't stand Word, but they're fine in Word because they've been using it for 20 years. I'm like, you know, God go with you. So yeah, I use Scrivener. I'm on a Mac. I have literally a filing cabinet here right by my desk where I keep my files, like my paper files and stuff. I have a set of in trays, in and out trays on my desk that I also use. Like I say, I'm really kind of old school and basic. I put stuff in folders. They go in the in tray or they go in the out tray or pending or whatever. I file them away in a filing cabinet. I have filing boxes for archives. And yeah, and I just have loads of folders on my computer containing, sort of my work. It's really not any more complex than that, because I don't think it needs to be. I think it's very easy, and I fell prey to this myself when I started out, for sure. It's very easy to get trapped in a loop of thinking that if only you can find the one magical tool,
right,
then suddenly you'll be, you know, that it will effectively write your book for you. Your book will write itself or whatever, or you'll suddenly be churning out 10 comic scripts a week. Right. If only you could find the right pen or the right paper or the right computer app. And I really don't think that's the case at all. And like I say, I understand I fell prey to that myself early on, but I luckily quickly kind of realized, oh no, hang on, this isn't working. This isn't true. You don't need all this fancy software. You don't need, a fancy desk setup and all that sort of thing. What you need are things that work for you consistently and that you feel comfortable with. And so that's why I say I can tell you what I use, but it may not be right for you. You may not be comfortable, like the example with, like I say, my friends, you know, trying to use Scrivener. You may not be comfortable using those things, but right. You may be comfortable using something else, something that I would never look at in a million years. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. What's important is the productivity and the results that you get out of it. If your setup means that you are able to produce those 1,000 words or 5 pages or whatever it is every day, or, you know, every session when you sit down to write, then that is clearly working for you. You know, if you're hitting your deadlines and you're making your word count and you're producing good work, don't change anything. You know, that just right. stick with what you're doing. There's no need mm-hmm. to go, oh no, I better change it because Anthony said he did it like this. Like, no, don't copy me. Just do what works for you. And right. So yeah, if what you have at the moment isn't working, then of course, by all means, try something new. Try maybe some of the things I do. Look for advice online or in books like The Organized Writer to try new ways, new methods, new processes, and you may find one that does work for you. But don't just copy somebody blindly and think that it will solve all your problems. And if it's already working for you, don't change anything.
Right, exactly. No, I wholly agree. So The Organized Writer, I think, has been one of my favorite books for organization in terms of, like, you know, really, like, it's like the core book for me. So thanks for
that. That's very, very kind of you to say. Thank you.
But I've also listened to, like, I've watched, like, I've had this app called Trello for years.
Oh, I know. And Trello. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I never figured, not until, like, a year or a half or so ago, I never really, actually, it was around when I read The Organized Writer, which, by the way, I'm pretty sure it was Kelly Sue that told me to read that.
Oh, it may well have been. Yes, bless her. Yeah,
pretty sure, yeah. It was. Yeah. But it was then that something clicked in my head, and I was like, I know how to use Trello. I know how to do this now. So one of the things that you mentioned in The Organized Writer, aside from the actual process of writing and being consistent about it and the setup of your office and your desk, one of the things you mentioned was, when you're in the writing process, anything can, like, set you off. Anything can, like, you know, attack your mind and tell you, go do that. Go wash the dishes. Go.
Right, yeah.
But things pop in your head. And you mentioned having something where you can quickly either jot it down, make a note of it, and then immediately cast it out and continue the writing
process. Oh, that's right. Yes. Yes. I do also keep a literal notepad on my desk, a pad and a pen on my desk. And if I am writing something and I have a sudden thought about, you know, some domestic chore that I have to do or whatever that is completely unrelated to writing, or even a thought that is writing related but not related to the project I'm currently, you know, that my fingers are currently typing,
then
I will make a note. I will literally just make a note longhand with a pen on that pad, put it in my inbox, in my trays, and then I can forget about it because I know I've captured it. I know I've got that thought down. I'm not going to forget it because I've written it down and put it in a tray, which I will look at later. So that is actually quite an important part of my setup.
I mean, that was one of the things that was like, it's so simple, but it's
so
like,
is that what you use Trello for now?
So yes. So
right.
When you write longhand, I have, so on Trello, you can create a widget, right?
Uh-huh.
And that widget is just a little button, and that little button can go directly to whatever list from Trello that you want it to go to. So the way I have my Trello set up, I have like lists of Monday through Friday or Sunday, so the whole week. And then on Sunday, I reset it up, and I have a thing I do called my Big Three. I learned that from this other organization podcast thing, the Focused Writer, I think it was, or Focus something. Anyways, I have my Big Three or whatever, and I have things that I plan out for the week that I want to do. And I only make three things every day for sure. I can have more than that, but there are three things for sure that day that I will do, no matter what, even if I have to stay up a little late to do it.
It's like the writing quota. As long as you've done those three things, you know that you've achieved stuff for the day. Yeah.
Exactly. And usually one of those Big Three is write however many words, you know, for that day. But I also have on that same Trello workspace something called New. And in the New section, that's where that button goes. So it's on my phone.
Right.
And if I'm writing, or if I'm doing anything, even if I'm not writing, if I'm out somewhere and I something pops up and I can't like really focus on it, I just hit the little plus button. It takes me right to the app, and I just type in, remember to order X thing for the convention I have.
Yeah, buy milk, whatever.
You know, right. I write it out, and then immediately I don't like thinking about what you said in the book. I'm like, that's my second memory. I don't have to think about it. So it really is a huge load. Especially when you're writing, it's the biggest load off your mind because you don't have to be fidgeting and thinking, oh, remember to get the milk. You just, it's written there. It's then you can go right back to writing. It's like a game changer. Like,
and it's such a simple thing. This is the beauty of it. Like these tiny little things like this, which take almost no effort to set up are so helpful as long as you use them. And this is again, what I mean about kind of, you know, do what works for you. The important thing is using these things, set up these methods, these processes, and then follow through on them. And the difference it can make is remarkable. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like that's the biggest, and that's even that is consistency. So the consistency of writing every day is important. And then the consistency of organizing your time in general is important, and making sure that in the time that you organize, like I'm a huge advocate for lists. I'm a huge advocate for write it down. People don't believe me. And I'm like, I promise you, my mom told me when I was a kid, I never listened. And only when I was like somewhere in my mid to late 20s, I was like, you know, maybe I should.
Hey, look, listen, I'm 50 years old. I can barely remember what I had for dinner 3 hours ago.
Right.
You know? My memory is completely shot. So, yeah, right. I write everything down. I never trust that I will remember anything, you know, beyond like the next 5 or 10 minutes.
Right, exactly. So if you write down even the things you have to do, in addition to write down the things that you want to do, for example, right?
Yeah.
Then that consistency becomes the norm, and then it's no longer it won't be a task. That's just what I do.
It's a habit. You know, that's what I said. It's like, you know, habits are easier to develop than willpower is easier to use.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've found anyway. Certainly for me, it is much easier for me to get into a routine and develop a habit than it is for me to kind of overcome my own resistances with willpower. And so if I can make those things, as you say, a habit, something that I don't even really have to think about doing,
right,
that is much easier for me than trying to overcome bad habits through sheer willpower. You know, I can do that eventually. I mean, I gave up smoking, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, so I can do it, but it's tough. It's much easier to just develop a good habit instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think putting things with those habits helps. Like I mentioned not too long ago, the habit of, I started making tea while, like, you know, right before it's time for the writing session. And so I'd sit down and I'd put on peppermint tea, and then like the smell of it even puts me in the mindset. It's
exactly
simple things like that. The smell of tea means time to write. It's like it's like if you ring the bell for the dog, for
the Pavlov's dog. Yeah.
Right.
No, but it's absolutely true. It absolutely works. Like I said, that's another of those things that sort of unconsciously prepares your mind for, okay, now we're going to sit down and write. These things are worth doing.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So I spent a lot of time talking about the organizing, the writing and stuff, because I'm not going to lie. I mean, I get excited about that stuff. Like, I get excited about, like, man, this is a method to do this thing. And I like that you said that the tool doesn't really matter as long as it works for you. I hope everybody who's listening to this takes that to heart. Like, whatever you want to use, like, you use Scrivener. The only reason why I don't use Scrivener all the way is because it doesn't sync as well with PC.
Right. Yeah. No, I've been a Mac head since like 1988. So.
right. So I tend to use Evernote because I know that if I'm writing something in Evernote, that as soon as I pull out my phone, it's still in Evernote. You know.
Yeah.
I do love Scrivener. I definitely write. Sometimes I actually do just copy and paste things from Evernote to Scrivener because it is excellent. But yeah, whatever tool works for you guys for whether it's writing itself, or organizing and writing like Trello, or if it's like old fashioned pen and paper, like do that.
Yep.
But yeah, so I do want to hit a little bit on, because I know we spent a lot of time talking about the organization of writing, but I do want to hit a little bit on all these different mediums you've worked in. So you've worked in, I think you mentioned everything but theater and teleplays, I think you said.
In terms of stuff that's been produced, yeah, or stuff I've been paid to write, I should say. Exactly. Yes, it's theater and TV are the two sort of things that I haven't yet done. But yeah, I've written books, I've written comics, graphic novels, I've written screenplays, I've written short stories, I've adapted books to graphic novels. All these different things, all these, you know, I mean, I'm also a podcaster and a musician, but let's not even get into those. So right, yeah, right. I as my bio says, I write all the things.
Right, all the things. Right. So I kind of want to get a picture of, because there's
video games. I completely forgot video games.
Video games is huge on the list too, right? All the Dead Space fans out there, the new one that just came out. I've got to get the new one. But yeah, so I just want to. I know there's people that want to write a little bit of everything, or they're trying to, or maybe they want to figure out what medium they want to get into first. Maybe what's your process like for, we'll just use examples because obviously we can't hit every medium, but like, how would you approach like a comic project? You know, a comic job that comes up versus say, hey, we're about to work on this video game. And I know a video game may be much bigger than a comic, but what do those processes look like for preparation?
Well, it's not just about size. Video game is kind of a job, a medium off by itself. really difficult to compare that to others. Not in terms of how I literally sit down and write, but in terms of approaching the gig and how the gigs come about, you know, sort of how you prepare for the work. Honestly, I don't behave all that differently. I don't write all that differently from project to project. My process for writing a story for a video game is not that different to how I would approach writing, you know, an outline or something for a comic book. Again, the details differ. Of course they do, you know, in sort of the script format or, you know, writing prose for a novel or something. But my routine doesn't change and my approach to telling stories doesn't really change. You know, I make notes longhand. I write out a rough outline. I'll turn that into a treatment. I turn the treatment into sort of a more detailed treatment, and then I start writing the thing. And that's the same from medium to medium. That's the same if I'm writing a book, a graphic novel, if I'm doing a comic series. Comic series, maybe I probably wouldn't go into the detailed treatment stage because there's kind of no point with a comic. That is your script, really. Your script is essentially a detailed treatment. But, you know, it's still that kind of each level gets a bit more detailed, a bit more granular, has a bit more information in it. With games, however, the big difference is, and this is kind of similar to screenplays or can be similar to screenplays, is that you are collaborating with an enormous number of other people, many of whom are not writers, but will have an influence on what you write and have input into what you write. Which, as I say, is the same for screenplays as well, but it's even more so with video games. So I will write an outline, you know, sort of rough outline for something, but then I can't just immediately start writing a more detailed version of that outline and turn it into a treatment. Instead, now it's got to go through a whole chain of approvals from people and probably changes and meetings and revisions and all that sort of thing. And, you know, people turning up and going, no, you can't do that because we haven't got the gameplay animations to cover it or whatever. So, because there's all these other departments where, you know, games, remember, is limited by technically what is achievable, much more so than any other medium. You know, even film, especially now, you know, where it's, you can do pretty much anything on screen that you like because CG is so good now, special effects are so good. Whereas in games, that's still not quite the case because you've got the interactivity to take into account, which brings a whole extra level of complication and, you know, ball aches to life. So, yeah, as I say, games is kind of one of those media that stands apart because it is so different to other things. However, like I said, I don't approach the writing particularly differently, the writing itself, when I just, you know, actually come to write a story. And what I've found anyway is that the skills I have developed in one medium can often be transferred to another.
Sometimes
a lot more than you might think at first. I actually, I've given a talk about this over the years, which I call Comics to Consoles, which is literally about sort of moving from comic books to writing video games and bringing the skills that I developed writing comic books and graphic novels across to writing stories and cutscenes for video games. And that skill transference is absolutely real. There is a lot you can take from comics and bring over to make you a better video games writer. But by the same token, I have found that some of the skills I've picked up in video games, I've also then been able to transfer back to comics and graphic novels. And then as I became more of a novelist, you know, some of those skills have transferred into my novels as well and to writing screenplays. So there's a lot more cross media parallels in skill sets than I think a lot of people realize. Certainly, as I say, that's what I've found anyway, is you know, you can move those skills around from medium to medium a lot more than might be apparent at first. And so that's just one more example, as I say, of the of how it's not all that different for me. What's different is, again, the details, like with the game, yeah, the interactivity and the collaboration with all these other departments. You know, in a screenplay, it's not so much collaboration, but it's having to deal with, you know, notes from executives and talking with a director and figuring out, you know, sort of how you want to approach things, taking notes from people who may not know the first thing about story, but the, hey, they get to have a say about what you're writing. That's, you know, that's the gig. With books, it's going deep and being more immersive. You know, the thing you can do in a book is really go inside a character's mind, much more so than in any other medium. In comics, it's the page turn. It's the fact that you've got the images and the words together, but no motion and no sound. You can do very interesting things with that. You can use them in really interesting ways. As I say, you've got the page turn and the sort of physical space of the page, which no other medium has. You know, comics is the only medium where you are physically limited by the size of the page in terms of what you can do. That's really interesting. You can use that to do innovative things. So every medium has its sort of strengths, and sometimes it's, you know, it's not flaws, but drawbacks, you know, things that it can't do. It's limitations. That's the word. It's strengths and it's limitations. But you can, because of that, you can do really interesting and unique things in each medium that wouldn't be possible in the other media. And that is why I really enjoy working across all these different media, because I get to do different things. People sometimes say to me, and it's a fair question. I understand why they ask it, but people say, you know, if you have an idea, do you know what medium you want it to be? Or do you just have an idea for a story and then decide afterwards, oh, this is going to be a game, or maybe I'll try and make this into a comic? And like I say, it's a fair question. I understand why people ask it, but certainly from my point of view, the concept of an idea itself is embedded in the medium in which I want to write it.
Right, right.
If I have an idea for a graphic novel, that's it. That's a graphic novel. I can't even conceive of then, you know, writing that same story as a video game or as a screenplay. I could adapt them, but adaptation is not writing the same story. And anybody who's done adaptation will tell you that, you know, this is why things change between mediums. So, I kind of, to me, the concept of the idea is tied up in a particular medium. I don't think I want to write a story about X. Now I'd better pick a medium in which to write it. It's, I want to write a screenplay about X, or I want to write a graphic novel about X. And so once I've had that idea, it's kind of locked in to that medium. This means, of course, that I have a lot of projects I've never finished writing because I can't sell them to anybody. But, you know, that's, I've made a rod for my own back, but that's life.
I mean, at some point, you may, somebody may pop up with something and then you may, that fits that one thing that I wrote.
Oh, that's definitely happened. Yeah.
But no, okay. So really quick, because you did mention the adaptation thing. So that's a big fan question that we get a lot. So I go to a lot of local conventions here in Atlanta, like Dragon Con and stuff like that. And I don't think I've ever been to a Dragon Con in which we were in a room with writers like Peter David and you know, Gail Simone, or, you know, people who have written over multiple mediums. And some, there's that one person that goes, why did you change my character? Like, honestly, quite entitled. Why did you change my character from this to that? You know, What is kind of your take on the process of adaptation and why things aren't, say, you know, exactly the same from, you know, say, the, for example, the comic page to the movie page, or from the book?
Because they can't be. You know, I mean, if you the book to screen is probably the best example of why it can't work. You know, even a short book, even a, say, a 60,000 word book, which by modern standards is very, very short, has so much in it that if you were to film every moment of that book, even putting aside what I said before about getting inside a character's mind, you know, and sort of even if you put all that aside and you only film the external moments, you would have like a 10-hour film. you just can't do it. This is why, thank goodness, now that we've reached this era where people are more in favorably inclined to adapt books as TV series instead of like limited streaming series, that's so much better, because then you've got room to actually put the whole story in. You can't do it in 2.5 hours. It's just impossible. Right. You can take a graphic novel and put it on the screen. That's about the right length. A short story. You know, look at, to take a couple of examples, some Philip K. Dick short stories, We Can Remember It for You Wholesale, which became Total Recall. Now, I mean, Total Recall is very different to the story. Right. But my point is that it's about the right length. It feels about the same amount of story, because a short story, you can film every moment of that, and it would make a 90-minute or 120-minute film. Mm-hmm. The short answer is simply that you can't do it. Where I've adapted prose works into comic books, a screenplay by Alan Moore and Malcolm McLaren called Fashion Beast that I adapted to a comic series. That had to be a 10-issue comic series order to adapt the entire screenplay, because that came, you know, that gig came with a very clear instruction of like, no, we literally just want you to adapt the entire screenplay. You know, don't go changing story on us or anything. Oh, okay, fair enough. But I also do a series of graphic novels adapting Anthony Horowitz's Alex Rider books, which are YA books about a teen spy. There's an Amazon TV series now as well, adapting them. And those are, again, they're not massively long. They're maybe 60, 70,000 word novels, but fitting them into a 160-page graphic novel, I've got to cut stuff. You know, I have to change things and cut things out, because otherwise they would be 1,000 pages long. Nobody's going to pay for that, let alone buy it. The short answer is simply that you can't. Now, to get to the flip side then is, okay, well, then what makes a good adaptation? You know, if that's the case, how can you make sure that you're doing a good adaptation? And the answer there, I think, is to capture the essence of the story and the characters, the main characters of the source material. And Atomic Blonde is a perfect example of that. I actually use that as a great example, because if you've read the graphic novel, The Coldest City, that Atomic Blonde is based on, it's not... You would be forgiven on a surface level for saying, well, this is nothing like the movie. They changed everything. Because the graphic novel is black and white. It's noirish. It's very sort of grim. It's, I was deliberately trying to sort of channel John le Carré into graphic novels. That was my stated aim, was to make a graphic novel that felt like you were reading a John le Carré book. Right. And the movie Atomic Blonde does not feel like a John le Carré story, obviously. It is saturated with color. You've got neon everywhere. There's, kicking and punching and tons more action than there is in the book. But, and remember, I was a co-producer on that. So I saw the screenplay as it was, and was giving notes on the screenplay as it was being drafted. And I, saw it being filmed and all that sort of thing. So I know how this came about. And if you actually look at the film and the characters in it, I mean, even though one of them has had a gender swap, for example, the basic story, the basic plot, and the essence of those characters is the same as in the graphic novel. That was one of the reasons why I was so delighted with Charlize's portrayal of the character, was she absolutely got the core of Lorraine from the graphic novel, even though she looks nothing like Lorraine. In the book, she absolutely understood that character, and she really, really got to the essence of what makes that character tick. And like I say, the plot is basically the same. You know, they just found Dave and Kurt found places in the graphic novel where off screen there might be a massive fight that lasts for 15 minutes, there might be a car chase through Berlin. It's just not shown on the page. So, and like I say, I'm laughing, but that's not to knock it at all, because if you'd actually just filmed what was in the graphic novel, it would be dull. Even I wouldn't want to watch that for 90 minutes, so I was really happy with the movie, and that's why I use it as a good example of, a good adaptation, because it maintained the essence of the plot and the structure of the story and the essence of all those characters, but did it in a way that could only make sense as a movie, and took advantage of the medium of movies and cinema and what have you to make this visual spectacle that was actually remarkably faithful to the original work. And that, I think, is how you get a good adaptation, when you can keep the essence, the core of something, but do it in a way that takes advantage of the new medium in which you're working. It's what I try to do with the Alex Rider graphic novels. Like I say, it's what Kurt and Dave did with Atomic Blonde. It's what all the best adaptations do, I think.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Understanding the core of the story. So you really have to understand story in order to do an adaptation.
Yeah.
Because I know there's the camp out there who probably aren't writers, who say stuff like, oh, well, an adaptation is much easier than, you know, than writing the story.
No, it's not.
there's a whole, I'm like, I don't know about that. Yeah. I mean, I'm not quite as, I don't have as many years of experience behind me, but I have done adaptations from short stories to comics and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, this is rough sometimes, especially when it's not my work. I've been hired to do so. So now I have to make sure that I understand what the core of their story is, and make sure that I'm transposing what they want it to portray in their story over to this other medium that they hired me to do, because they know nothing yep. about comics, for example, and make sure that I'm capturing like what comics do well. Like you said, every medium has its strengths, right? So I have to like get the page turn and stuff like that. Make sure I get that down while still capturing what, you know, what the short story was trying to do, or the novel, whatever it was trying to do, and not miss like the key things that the writer wanted to come forth, you know, wanted to be important. So yeah, it's definitely
it is not as easy as people think. No,
right, it is a challenge. But yeah, okay. So we're gonna get ready to wrap up pretty shortly here. Did have one more small question on the topic of mediums, really quick. Mm-hmm. If a writer is brand new, like the last thing they wrote was something in high school, and they're like, okay, I want to be a writer. Do you think that they should say they want to write video games? Do you think that they should dive straight into the video game world, or do you think that they should start with something else? Or even if it's movies, should they dive right into screenplay, or should they start with something with less strings attached, I would say?
No, I think you should. I think if you have your mind set on a particular medium, then you should start working in that medium. That's not to say that you can't also work in other media. You know, you might enjoy writing short stories on the side or something, but you should absolutely focus on the medium in which you have an ambition to work, because that is how you learn to write for that medium. But also, going back to what I said earlier, because the skills that you'll learn will stand you in good stead across all media anyway. But absolutely, you should focus on the medium in which you want to work, because, otherwise you there's a risk that you could spin your wheels for years. You know, every medium, as we've said, has its strengths and limitations. Every medium has its own format, its own rhythms, its own tropes and expectations. And the only way you can really learn those is by writing that medium, by reading that medium, by absorbing it, and then writing, you know, taking that into yourself, and then using it as influence to write your own material. I think that's absolutely essential. So definitely focus on the medium in which you want to work. Now, the problem is, for something like, say, movies or video games, how do you do that? How do you get into those industries?
That's gonna be the next question.
Right. And I mean, that's the inevitable follow-up question, and that is tough. Obviously, my advice, and this is true for any medium, actually, for comics, books, video games, movies, whatever it is, my advice is always to make something small. Working with other people if need be, you know, if it's games or if it's screenplays or whatever, you know, find a small group of people who are on your level, who are on the same level as you, and work together to make something really small. And I mean really small. I'm talking like, you know, a 4-minute short film. Or, you know, a sort of 2D platformer with three levels or something, if it's a video game, you know, something really, really small and simple small and achievable.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Don't think that you're immediately going to make a Call of Duty sized game, you know, or that you're going to make a 2-hour movie or something. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if you set out to try and do it, you're just setting yourself up for failure. Make mm-hmm. something small, make a webcomic, you know, a 3-4 page webcomic, put it up online, get mm-hmm. critiques, let people read it. It can become a calling card that you send to editors and publishers. If you make mm-hmm. a short film, obviously, you know, if you're proud of it, you can try submitting it to festivals. And like, if you're not proud of it, well, hey, you've had a really, really great learning right. experience. And the next time you do it, you will be proud of it. You know, the way you learn to do something is by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you learn to write something is by writing it. And right. nothing will teach you how to make games or movies or graphic novels or whatever it is, or write a book even. Mm-hmm. Nothing will teach you how to do those things better than doing it, even right. if it's on a small scale. Again, if you want to be a novelist, you know, write a short novel, take part in NaNoWriMo, you know, every November, 50,000 words. Now, 50,000 mm-hmm. words, don't get me wrong. As I said earlier, that's by modern standards a very short novel, but it's still a whole chunk of words. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody mm-hmm. who finishes NaNoWriMo gets a salute from me, because I know myself that 50,000 words is not an easy number to hit, right. You know, unless you are really putting in the work. So, yeah, make something and then use that thing as your calling card and a way to move on and make something again, and maybe make something a bit bigger and a bit more ambitious next time, or to try and get commissions from within the industry. I know people who have gone to game jams where a whole bunch of people basically get together and in the space of 24 or 48 hours make tiny, tiny little video games. I know people who've gone to game jams, made a tiny game there, and then that game has been enough. You know, they put it up online or whatever, you know, in a browser-based engine or something, has been enough to get them a job. Right. You know, it's part of their resume. They like, you know, they're actively seeking jobs at the same time, but that is what gets them over the line, because somebody sees it and goes, ah, they have made a thing. They know what it takes to make a thing, because believe me, even a tiny little game at a game jam is not a simple thing to make, you know.
Right.
There will be all manner of heartache and ups and downs and highs and lows crammed into those 48 hours, more than you could ever imagine. You know, so seeing that, or as I say, again, somebody seeing a short film that you've made, they will see that and go, they've made this thing. They know what it takes to make a thing. And that, the experience of doing that, puts you in such a better position than somebody who hasn't. Could it not? And so it can help you get on. It can help you make contacts. It can help you get commissions. It can help you find work. And it will certainly make you a better writer.
Right.
That surely is the most important thing.
Right, right. Yeah, it's doing it. Like, there's nothing better than just doing it. I have a buddy who recently, I was trying to get him to get on Masterclass. We have like a Masterclass pool that we're all kind of putting into, because Masterclass is great. And he was so worried. He was like, I feel like I may waste it because I'm afraid of writing. What if I write my script and it's bad? And I was just like, you have to write to be maybe your first script will be bad. Like, and you just can't, sometimes you have to accept that.
Then write another one.
Right. Exactly. If it's bad, first of all, if it's bad, it's your first draft, and most first drafts are bad. And if you're very new to writing, like you said, write something else. I guess a good thing to ask, and kind of in closing to get ready to get out of here, is what would you tell him or somebody like that who says, oh, I'm afraid to write my script or whatever because I'm afraid it's going to be bad?
I would say that again, yeah, you write the thing, and then if you look back at it and go, oh no, that's not very good, that's actually good. That's progress, because that means that A, you're self-critical enough to realize that it's not good, but also means that you've finished that and you can put it aside now and you can write something else. You can do something new. The important thing is that you finished the first thing. I'm a big advocate of this. I talk about this a lot. You must finish things, because until something is finished, and I don't necessarily, if you're writing a screenplay, of course, I don't mean actually making a 90-minute film. I mean finish writing. Because so many things, like screenplays, novels, especially the longer form works, people start them and then 30 or 40% in, they go, oh, this isn't going as well as I thought it would be. And they abandon it and they put it to one side and they immediately start working something else. If right. you keep doing that, you will not learn. The way you learn is by finishing something, finishing a screenplay, finishing a book, finishing a graphic novel script. Until it is finished, you can't learn from it. And the reason for that is that until it's finished, you're thinking at the back of your mind, ah, yeah, but I can fix it. It's not finished yet. I can fix it in these last 20 pages, or I can go back and revise. I can still somehow make it this wonderful, magical thing that I had in my head when I first had this idea, that isn't reaching the page. You'll fool yourself. I've done it myself. Again, I'm speaking from personal experience here. You will fool yourself into thinking that you can fix it, but you never actually get round to finishing it. And so that fixer-upperness is all taking place in your imagination. It's not mm-hmm. real. And mm-hmm. so you can't critique it. But when you finished it and you look at it and you go, oh, no, that's not very good. That's not at all as good as what I had in my mind. Well, like I say, that's good because you understand that. And now you can critique it. Now you can go, why isn't it as good mm-hmm. as what I had in my imagination when I first started this project? Where did I fail? Why isn't it as good? Why doesn't this scene work? You can pull it apart. You can right. self-critique. Nobody else has to see this. That's the other thing. You don't have to embarrass yourself by showing it to other people. You mm-hmm. know, you can do this yourself, because having finished it and seen that it falls short, as every story inevitably does, literally everything ever written fall short of its creators' hopes and dreams, believe me. You know, even stuff that goes on to be published, literally everything. So that having happened, you critique it, and then you move on to your next project with the knowledge you've gained from that failure, essentially. You know, because you can look back at that first script, book, manuscript, whatever it was, and go, oh, that didn't work. Well, if you can examine it and figure out why it didn't work, or at least you think why it didn't work, then you can put that into practice on your next project, and that one will be better. And it still won't be perfect. And again, you can critique it. And so, and that's how you progress. But right. you have to right. finish these things in order to have that progression, in order to improve, because until it's finished, as I say, the perfect imaginary version still lives in your head, and you can, it's easy to convince yourself that you could fix it if you could be bothered. Right. And it's not true. You know, it's a pernicious lie that you tell yourself to feel better. And like I say, I understand we all do it, but the truth is you need to finish it so that you can critique it. And once you've done that, you will inevitably progress and improve when you come to do it the next time.
Right. Right. I love that you speak with it, within reality. I love that you speak with so much reality, because I mean, it sounds strange to say that, kind of, because it's like, well, of course, it's like, it's just the truth. It's the obvious truth, right? But there's, like I said earlier, there's so much, it's okay, don't worry about that. Oh, just, you know, like there's so much like false, I don't know, out there, you know what I mean?
This is the advantage of being British, you see. I can speak my mind and people expect it, you know? Nobody expects me to be a ray of sunshine and positivity. It's great.
No, but really, I really do appreciate like truth like that, because it's not about being, some people say, oh, it's harsh or that's mean. It's like, it's not about being mean. It's about being honest. And most of all, not somebody else being honest with you, but you being honest with yourself. If you can yes. look at, like you said earlier, if you look at your screenplay and say, this isn't good, or this isn't what I wanted it to be, at least what about it doesn't work? And then you have the mind to reverse analyze it. You know, you have the mind to, and that in itself is, like you said, making you a better writer. Like being able to deconstruct things. Like I don't watch, I'm sure it's the same for you. I don't watch TV or movies without inevitably deconstructing like something about it.
Yeah.
Like whether it's good or bad, I'm just always like, oh man, that was good. Why was that good? Let me figure it out, you know?
Yeah. Or that was not good. Or I wouldn't have done that. I would have done that a different way, you know?
Right, exactly. Or what, yeah. And then what would I have done? Something about this feels off. What would I have done differently here? You know? But yeah, it's like, that's what it is when you're, like I said, your writer's brain is on, you know? But no, this has been great.
It's just on that last point, really. I mean, it is about being honest, and that's partly because I think it's a disservice not to be honest when people are asking for advice. You know, I'm not saying anything that any other professional, full-time, experienced writer would not tell you. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have access to kind of some kind of magical specialist knowledge that nobody else does. You know, every other working writer will tell you the same things. The problem mm-hmm. is that sometimes, as you say, it's not politic to speak mm-hmm. the truth, or people right. just don't want to hear it. But my feeling is that I wish there are times when I wish people had been more honest with me. When I was starting out, I wish I'd had somebody telling me these truths when mm-hmm. I started out, because I maybe, you know, would have got it, made a success of it a bit sooner. Maybe I wouldn't have meandered a little as I did quite a bit at the start of my career, to be honest with you. You know, maybe I would have zeroed in on a few things a bit quicker. So I don't think it does anybody a service to sugarcoat these things, because this is mm-hmm. hard work. No, yeah. It's not digging ditches. It's not sweeping the streets. Of course, I understand that. But it is hard work. It's mentally taxing work. Mm-hmm. And at the end of a good day of writing, I am knackered. I am tired and exhausted and drained. And that's good. It's also a great feeling, because I know that I've done the work and I've got mm-hmm. I've made that progress. I've hit my word count. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, it is hard work, and you have to do it day in, day out. But that's the job. That's what you're signing up for. And so, like I say, I don't think it does anybody any good. It does anybody a service to lie to them in that way, or not lie, but sugarcoat things in that way and not tell them these things that are true and they may not want to hear, but they're going to find them out sooner or later. You know, whether they whether they find them out for themselves or whether they hear them from me, one way or another, they are going to find them out. And so why not help them get a head start? Why not give them the benefit of my wisdom and my experience? I say wisdom, I should actually just stick to experience. But give them the benefit of my years, you know, sort of sitting at this keyboard and banging out words every day. You know, you do learn a few things after a time. And we are all on this planet for a blessedly short time, you know? So let's not waste any of that time by sending people down the wrong alleys. We're off on the wrong path because we don't want to tell them the truth, or we think that we might be being too harsh. I don't think that does anybody any favors at all.
Yeah, we don't want to hurt feelings. Yeah. So somebody asked me very recently, this is a very last quick point. Somebody asked me very recently, well, they were talking to me about something that they were writing. They found out that I wrote some comics and stuff, and they were like, oh, I write too. And I recognized very quickly that they were very new, which is fine. I'm a new writer. I consider myself still new, but like this, I mean, very, very new, you know? And they were showing me things and bits and pieces that they were asking me these questions, and I didn't know them very well. And at a certain point in the conversation, I asked them, I said, okay, what do you want to do with this writing? Are you just writing for fun as a hobby? Or do you want this to be, do you want to be a writer? Do you want this to be a business, something that you pursue as a career, whether it's on the side or full time? And they said, I want it to be a business. And I said, okay, if you want it to be a business, and I told them a little about myself, like I'm not mean, I'm not overly, like, I'm not going to attack you or anything like that. But if you want this to be a business, you're asking me these questions, would you like me to be honest? There was a long pause because we were typing messages. There was a long pause and they were like, I don't know, I think you're gonna like rag on my stuff. And I'm like, no, it's not about ragging on it or anything, but I asked this question because it seems like you're very interested in, like, you're talking to me a lot about this. It seems like you're very serious about it, and I want to address early and be honest early about that. And they're not like, what I've seen, we were like horrible, but there were some things that were
sure
to me obvious, like, okay, don't do this, maybe do this, you know? And I was like, okay, I'm going to be honest then. And then after that, we were able to have a pretty, you know, productive conversation about the process. But it's like, I do hit those points a lot where I am talking to somebody and I try to kind of stand off a little bit, because I'm like, all right, I don't want to be the guy that's like the immediate douchebag who, you know.
Don't be harshing their buzz, man. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But then after a certain point in the conversation where they're, you know, repeatedly like pressing, I'm like, okay, this person seems serious. Let's see how serious they are. If they're serious, then they're going to tell me, yes, be honest with me. And yeah, again, we had really productive conversations. So I think like that's what this kind of like the last thing you said kind of brought up in my mind. And I'm sure that's maybe something like that's happened with you in the past. I don't know.
Yeah, it's all about managing expectations. As you say, you've got to kind of figure out, okay, are you serious?
Right. Exactly.
You know, or as you say, are you doing this just for fun? And that's okay. Again, mm-hmm. if you're doing it just for fun, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I said I'm a musician earlier. I am. I do the musician purely for fun. You know, like I have no expectations of making a living in it or, you know, of even making much money from it. I put my stuff up a Bandcamp and, you know, one person buys an album every couple of months or something. It's, you know, that's not why I do it. I do it because I love it and I get a great sense of fulfillment and pleasure out of it. It's not something that I'm trying to turn into a career. So there's nothing wrong with writing being that as well. I know people who do that, who write novels and novels worth of, you know, fanfic and stuff like that. They have no ambitions whatsoever to be professional writers, but they get enormous pleasure and fulfillment from writing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words of fanfic. That's great. Again, you know, wellness and are you well? Are you happy? Is your mental health good? These things are important. And if that's what does it for you, brilliant. But if you're not, if that's not you, and if you are serious, and if you do want to make a career out of it, then yeah, you have to grow a thick skin and be prepared to hear the truth. And the truth is that when you start out, you're not going to be very good, and you will get a lot of harsh feedback, and you need to accept it and take it and learn from it, because that's how you get better and how you reach a stage where you get good feedback and you don't get such harsh notes from people. I mean, not that they never entirely, you know, they never entirely go away, but you know what I mean? It's, that's how you get better. So, yeah, you just have to be honest. Again, self-awareness, as we talked about before, you have to be honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. Is this what you want to do for a living as a profession? If so, toughen up, you know? If not, that's fine. Like I say, nothing wrong with that whatsoever, but don't fool yourself into thinking that you do, you know thyself.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, honestly, this has been like great advice all the way through. Great inspiration all the way through. I mean, I feel like I want to get off and go write.
good.
yeah. No, I thank you a lot for coming on, especially talking about the organized part. Everybody, please go get The Organized Writer. It's, I'm telling you, it'll be a game changer if you go get it. Like, it's one of the best thing. Like, I've already been kind of a person that tries to organize things. But that book did really give me even more perspective. It's what really set me down after listening to the Focus, whatever, I can't remember the name of that podcast, the Focus Whatever podcast, and watching Trello videos on YouTube. Like, that was the thing that pulled it all together, and then I was able to create a system that works for me, you know? So definitely get that book if you're a writer. It helps a lot. But yeah.
I'll just tell people, actually, if you want to read more about it, go to organized-writer.com. You know, and that's a website specifically for the book. I mean, it's got pre-order links and stuff, obviously, but it would also just tell you a bit more about what's in the book and how it can help you if you are somebody who's looking to get more organized in your writing life. So yeah, it's organized-writer.com. Just go there. That's also got links to me if you want to find me on social media and things like that. But that's a good place to start.
Right, right. And can you tell people what you're working on? I know right now you have the dog.
The dog sitter detective. That's coming out in May. I am actually working on the second dog sitter detective book, which is called Death in Little Venice. I'm working on that right now. I'm also working on another video game project, but I can't say what that is.
Right, right.
as is always the case with video games.
Yep.
It's a world awash in NDAs. So yeah, there's a few things sort of in the pipe, but my main focus at the moment is launching the Dog Sitter Detective and writing the second book in the series.
Awesome. And where can people find you at on the internet, social media and stuff like that?
Well, like I say, if you go to organized-writer.com, that's got links to like my website and my social media, but it's basically just my name, which is anthonyjohnston.com, or on Twitter, I'm @AnthonyJohnston. On Mastodon, I'm @AnthonyJohnston on mastodon.social. Instagram, again, it's just my name. As long as you spell it correctly, that's the important thing. Spell my name right and you will find me on social media, because almost nobody else spells it the way I do.
Right. Exactly. It's not Anthony, it's Antony.
Yep. And there is a T in Johnston. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. well, awesome. Again, thank you so much for coming on. hopefully maybe we can have you back in the future.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I definitely appreciate all of your insight. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.